Hey there, everyone. Thanks for listening to Limited Engagement. I'm your host for the show, Jared Duran. And it's been a minute since I said any of that. And you know what? It feels pretty good. We'll get to that in a sec. Anyway, my guests on the show today are Kevin Smokler and Christopher Boone, who made a great little documentary called Vinyl Nation. And I'll get more into that in just a bit. It's been a little over 6 months. I feel like I'm in confession now, which is odd for a Jew. It's been a little over 6 months since my last confession. A lot of shit's been going down since. Some of it in flames. But so I, you know, consequently, I don't really know where to begin, and so I'm not going to. I recorded this conversation on election night, and there's just all sorts of shit up in the air, anxiety out the ass. It was admittedly a rough one. And, from which this conversation was a really nice reprieve. I had very much intended to disengage from any sort of media, social media, news, anything, because, you know, in a situation like this, I've cast my vote. I cast it weeks before the election. And what is there to do other than to be incredibly anxious and a little panicky? But of course I caved and was hitting refresh constantly on that map. And I'm happy to say that I'm recording this intro on the day that the election was called. Biden and Harris won. It's, you know, absolutely. It's just the very beginning. So much more work has to be done, and everyone needs to be held to account. But we had to start somewhere. And, you know, I was hoping with all of my heart that it was going to be a decisive victory, that there was just going to be blue all over the place. And I was a little disheartened that that was not necessarily the case. But again, to look at it as, you know, Biden and Harris won the popular vote. They, fucking turn Georgia blue and, you know, Pennsylvania, Nevada, turn my state, my adopted home state, my home for the last, you know, nearly 30 years, turn that blue. Arizona, we voted the Biden-Harris ticket. We voted Mark Kelly, so we now have both of our senators are Democrats, one of whom is a bisexual woman, and, you know, voted to increase education funding, or at least, you know, reassess the and proportionally raise, you know, the rate at which, tax for education can be raised, and legalize marijuana. And I tell you, when I started voting 20 years ago, that was just so far out of the realm of possibility. And as a staunch cynic, it's, you know, looking at those things, you know, anything is possible. And, you know, it's enough to to, you know, raise a little bit of hope. That's right. I'm on the record as saying that now. But, you know, and it seems like it's we've got some pretty gusty winds going here. It looks like it's going to rain. It seems like the earth itself is expressing relief, and who can blame it? It's it certainly makes me want to cry a little bit. Tears of joy, but it's just, how long have our assholes been clenched collectively, honestly, you know? So that's how I'm going to come back with that statement. How long have our assholes been collectively clenched? Fucking A. So my guests, as I mentioned, Kevin Smokler, Christopher Boone, they collectively put this documentary together, directed and produced, called Vinyl Nation. It's a love letter to the culture of record collecting and record collectors and record stores. And yet is not an unabashed celebration of it. It is, it's a film that looks at some of the problematic nature, both from a manufacturing standpoint and from a cultural standpoint. And as such, I loved the documentary. I thought it was great. And I highly recommend that you see it. It is available online currently. If you go to vinylnationfilm.com, it's been released digitally. Here in Arizona, Alamo Drafthouse, Dan D'Agostino Master Audio Systems, and Pucifer the Store. Is it Pucifer? I never know how to say that. Are three of the companies that have partnered with them to show the film. And when you purchase a ticket through these partners, go to the Where to Watch link. It says right there, Vinyl Nation virtual cinema tickets. 50% of ticket proceeds after platform fees go to each of their partners. Excuse me. So please do check it out. Again, it's vinylnation.com. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kevin Smokler and Christopher Boone, and talk to you just a little bit on the other side. Thanks so much for making the time to do that again. It's election night. I hope you guys got your vote cast in plenty of time.
Yep, indeed.
And it's even more harrowing than the last one, because it feels like so much more is at stake, you know, democracy versus fascism and whatnot. So, but I'm excited to talk to you guys about Vinyl Nation, because, it's a great, you know, great reprieve for this evening to, take the focus to something else for a little bit. And also, I loved the film. Thank you guys so much for sending me the link to it. I don't know who how you got my name, but I'm glad for whoever gave it to you, because I enjoyed it thoroughly. I'm a music junkie, and I've been collecting since I was a kid. So it was really, really refreshing to see a documentary about the culture that you know, and we'll get into it more specifically, but that while it celebrates the culture, you guys also don't shy away from looking at some of the more problematic aspects of the culture as well. So I want to get into all that, but first, just to sort of start off, how did this come about? What was the idea? Who formed the idea? Are you guys both music junkies yourself? So.
This is Kevin. Yeah, I would say we are, but we've had very different journeys and paths to getting there. I think, for example, Chris has worked at a record store, and I never have. I've just spent a lot of time in record stores, but. I came to records quite a bit earlier than Chris. Neither one of us were first generation record people. We're both just slightly too young to have come of age when records were the only way to listen to music. we both came about in the cassette generation, and by the time we were teenagers, we were fully into the CD generation. But it was about 2007 when I found myself in my early 30s back interested in records again. And I thought it was, frankly, I just thought it was a weird hobby, and you know, it wasn't much different than model train building to me at that point. I just thought it was a thing I liked. And then we started seeing in the news and just for people who love music, 2007 marks the point that the upswing in records begins, that the record renaissance, as we now know it, begins in America, which has continued unabated since then. Here in 2020, during a pandemic this summer, the record sales in the United States, final record sales in America, were up rather than up over last year when there was no pandemic. So, of course, 2020 is the first time that record sales have outpaced CDs since 1986. We are in the 13 years and no sign of stopping. But again, it was cool that it was a trend. I just thought it was like a thing I was into. I didn't see it as a subject until Chris and I, who went to college together, got reacquainted in about 2016 or so. We don't live in the same place. I live in San Francisco, and Chris lives in Albuquerque. But I came to Albuquerque on book tour at Chris's invitation. And we got back in touch, and it was clear that we both liked a lot of the same things, and we were good at, like, the areas that I was bad at, Chris was really good at, and the areas that I'm good at, Chris is good at also. So that's kind of how that's kind of how it all shook out. and Chris is an experienced filmmaker, and I'm a rookie filmmaker. So when it was clear that we worked well together, I naturally was like, well, here's a thing that Chris is good at. And so maybe this is something we could do together. And since I've always loved documentaries, and my, you know, day job up until this point was writing nonfiction books, I only know how to tell a story in a nonfiction way. And so when I proposed a nonfiction film to Chris about this topic that had been nagging at me, basically, what does the comeback of records mean now that at that point it had been going on for 10 years unabated and no sign of slowing down? I never made a documentary before. I'm kind of interested in the topic. Well, let's start talking about it and see where we end up. Chris, you want to pick up the story from there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great summary for it. I got into records probably around 2014. And like Kevin said, I was too young to really be into it in the first go round. But my wife was the one who actually bought the turntable, and that was, you know, a bad idea, I think, on her part, because I was like, "Whoa, I can buy records now! Like, cool." And I go through phases when it comes to music and like acquiring music in physical formats. And I was feeling really disconnected to music, to be honest, until we got the turntable. I wasn't necessarily. I mean, I was checking out new music, but I like streaming. We have Spotify, but I don't use it a ton. I do use it, but like radio out here in New Mexico, I hate to say, isn't great for music, at least for my personal taste. So I just hadn't really felt connected to music in many years. And then once I got the turntable, I was like, oh yeah, this is actually what I've been looking for, a way to connect with music again. But when Kevin brought the idea to me, I was more interested in looking into it, because I have a daughter who's now 17, but she got her own turntable maybe a year after my wife and I got ours, and she collects her own records. And I just find it fascinating that there are young people who never had any other physical format of music other than vinyl records. Like, they listen to iTunes, now Spotify, and now they get records. And like, she's never owned a CD player or anything like that. So I just thought that was fascinating. And I was curious to explore the world of who's now into vinyl records. Like, I've gotten back into them. Kevin's gotten back into them. My teenager's into them. Like, there's got to be this bigger world out there that's into them. And we were more interested not so much in why this is happening, but like, what does this mean for where we are today in America, like that all these other people are coming to vinyl records. And so that's what really kind of sparked the idea for me and led us to doing kind of a bunch of research before we started making the film.
You know, it's crazy. I was born in 82, so it's you know, I grew up with records in the house, though. I had all my mom's records to play. I actually had my grandparents' records to play, too. So I grew up with a lot of, like, stuff that I still listen to. I first heard, like, Crowded House back then. I first heard Talking Heads, I recall. And then, you know, my grandparents had a lot of old folk and jazz records. So I was even listening to, like, Ornette Coleman like Bob Dylan and of course all that classic stuff. So I you know, and my family adopted this CD player pretty late. I didn't have my own CD player until like 98 or 99, I want to say. So it was, you know, as we were late to adopt so many things, I listened to records for a long time, but of course I had, you know, I would buy cassettes growing up, and then, you know, I still have, you know, a few thousand CDs that I'm slowly, you know, replacing with records. And I have probably about 1,000 records or so, but it's interesting that, that as somebody who has collected music for, you know, again, since they were a kid, it's such a way to, you know, and I'm an avid book collector. I'm a huge film buff, and yet it's always music that seems the most immediate. And it seems in a way that just consistently defines you as well. And I feel like that comes through in the film. Also, was that something that you had initially known that you wanted to explore, people's connection to music? Or was that, you know, that something that that just revealed itself as you were conducting interviews and so forth?
When we started talking about making Vinyl Nation, which at the time we had a title and that was about it. Like we didn't know. We had kind of a vague idea that it was that this story could best be told as a documentary film, because records are a physical medium, and are objects as much as they are conveyances of music. So in order to capture their physicality, we felt we had to do so in a visual medium rather than, you know, jointly doing a 10-part podcast series about it or jointly writing a book about the resurgence of records or something like that. But I don't know. I mean, we also knew that for the what is immediately the hook to that story, we were way too late to the party for that. Like, by the time we started talking about it, the comeback of records was a decade old. Mm-hmm. And so, like, there wasn't 90 minutes of a movie to just ask why. Like that question had been debated enough already. There probably wasn't 10 minutes for a short film about that question.
Well, because especially since a lot of people would argue that the love of vinyl and people collecting it hardcore for a long time never went away. It just kind of was subsumed for a little while.
Yeah. And that was an argument we were not interested in at all.
Sure.
Yeah. So we kind of focused on the question of what does it mean initially? And in the course of making the movie, i.e. principal photography, I think Chris and I had decided before we ever began shooting that we were going to focus on sort of what was not commonly perceived as a record person, but just based on the idea that, like, if records were coming back, they weren't coming back with the same people who had liked them, who had liked them all along, because that's not a comeback. That's mm-hmm. just like, so we figured there was a new, like, record person out there. And so we deliberately looked for people who did not look like your stereotypical record person. And that meant talking to a lot of women and people of color and really young people who had no relationship with records at all. Or parents and kids, or, And those specific categories. So initially we were like, oh, well, this is about like the table getting bigger, the people sitting around the table called Record Fan getting bigger. Mm-hmm. And it was only very late in the process that we fell into what we later learned is an absolute cliche, but a true one about documentary filmmaking, and that whatever you think your movie is about, when you start filming it, you will be wrong. it's actually probably about something different, which you will and you will uncover that during the process of making the movie. And of course, we were like, that's not going to happen to us. Like, why would we even bother if we didn't know what our movie was about? And of course, it happened to mm-hmm. us. But we ended up learning really during post-production that we had in fact made a movie about human connection. And that the record, a flat black plastic circle, was simply a visual metaphor for how music is a universal human language and connects us all.
Yeah, that was actually one of the first things our editors noticed as they were going through the raw footage. And they said, you know, we interviewed, I think, 45 people specifically, not counting the people we interviewed on the day of Record Store Day or at Austin Record Convention. And that's what one of our editors, Jason Whaling, said to us. He said, I think if you put any of these 45 people in a room together, even though they've never met, even though they could come from totally different walks of life and are very different people except for records, they'd be fast friends because of this connection they have to music through vinyl records. And it would be, and he's like, it's just obvious. You can see it in the footage. And so part of the fun of putting together the narrative from the interviews was finding both the things that were in common with these people and actually cross-cutting between characters who mm-hmm. seem quite different. And then when you would think like, oh, everyone's gonna have the same opinion about vinyl records and things like that, like finally like, no, actually it's like all over the place. and still like you can have all these diverse opinions about records, then yet you're still part of this group of people that loves them. It just can be for totally different reasons. So that was just really fascinating to see unfold during the post-production process.
Now, so that kind of naturally brings me to something that I touched on at the beginning, but that I do want to spend some time talking about. There is this, there's certainly this perception, and it's been, you know, highlighted and spotlighted by popular media and films and books that I personally love. You know, I saw High Fidelity when it first came out, and of course, you know, my that was, you know, the point at which I said, oh, I want to own my own record store. You know, and that of course quickly went away. But you know, the idea of that being a very kind of elitist boys club. And you clearly found some really like hardcore collectors that, you know, you would never put in the typical box. And that's something that, as you know, for selfish reasons, that I love seeing highlighted, because, you know, as, you know, over the course of relationships that I've had and been, you know, told that my collecting is a guy thing, that just, you know, completely tells a different side of it.
That was really important to us. I mean, one thing that Chris and I laugh about a lot is if you read one interview with Nick Hornby, because he has been very open about it.
Right.
High Fidelity, the novel, is critical of those people, deeply critical of those people. And it was basically Nick Hornby was saying like, look how pathetic I was when I was that age. And I know better now. And he has been very, very vocal about that. And somehow I don't think Stephen Frears, when he made High Fidelity, the movie, was any more, was any kinder to the people in that movie. I do not think he was saying you want to be Rob Gordon.
Right.
And yet people watch that movie and I don't confess to being one of those people, but I can totally see how people watch that movie and say, I would love a record store where I can sit there and make fun of guys in khakis all day long.
It's funny because, you know, I've always said the evolution of that is that, you know, when I was a young adult, I wanted to be the John Cusack character. And as, you know, as a guy in his late 30s, now I realize I was the person who wanted the Captain Beefheart record. You know, it's
yeah. Yeah. And the funny thing is, and we didn't know this either. We just know that, we knew high fidelity movie and novel were a product of the pre-record renaissance, right, when records were a scarcity and therefore people could form a little priesthood around them. Mm-hmm. And so we knew that was an anachronistic perspective for our movie in particular. What we did not know, and was really a pleasant surprise when making the movie, was that the idea that you are going to walk into a record store in 2020, and the person behind the counter is going to make fun of you for wanting to buy, you know, I just called to say I love you. It is weird. It is weird. Like you would, that would be a rarity now. And in fact, now the expectation is you walk into a record store and the person behind the counter, is like the concierge at a fancy hotel, is like, what can I help you with? And how can I, and if your thing is Taylor Swift, or if your thing is Mobb Deep, we got it all here.
Yeah.
Sandy Bittman, the owner of the fantastic independent record store Park Avenue CDs in Orlando, Florida, says, like, if we don't have something for, you know, the guy who wants Led Zeppelin or the teenage girl who wants Taylor Swift, if we don't have something for all those people, we failed. Like, we're not doing our job as a record store.
Right.
That, I mean, Sandy's on that record store for 30 years, and he's a veteran. But the reason he's in our movie is because that is a unique perspective to this time in record retailing.
But it's also something that you have to get over. Initially I was scared to death that whoever was selling me the records behind the counter was going to judge me for, you know, the fact that I might have a Billy Joel record or two in there. You know, it's definitely a culture shift to be more inclusive.
Well, I mean, and that's right in the beginning of our movie, for when people see it, like the opening scene is Record Store Day at Mills Record Company in Kansas City, Missouri, and it's owned by Judy Mills. And the first thing she says to all of her employees, like, what's today about? It's about quick, authentic connections. And it's only quick because it's Record Store Day and there are just so many people there. Mm-hmm. But really, it's for her, and it always has been, it's always about authentic connections. It's not about selling records. She doesn't say that. It's about making those connections, because these are all friends that they either have already made or they want to make, because you want the record store to be a place where people want to stop when they're on their way somewhere else, but they're driving by and they right. want to pop in and say hello and maybe, oh, shop a little bit and discover. I mean, at the same time, it's not a mistake or even clever marketing, I would even argue, that, you know, when you go to try to reboot High Fidelity, you're going to cast Zoe Kravitz as the main character yeah. owning the record store. And it's not even just because it's an homage to her mom, Lisa, being in, you know, Lisa Bonet being in the film. It's like, you know, that is what a record store owner looks like in today's times. Mm-hmm. Like, she is much more representative of record store owners, just like Judy Mills and all these other women who have opened up record stores. You know, some of them have been doing this since forever, but others, like Judy, who did it starting with the resurgence of vinyl records. And they are, as Kevin's pointed out, much more welcoming, and they aren't going to make fun of you for what you're getting. And in fact, they're going to, like, get excited about what you're bringing up, because they right. want a diversity of customers coming to their stores.
As you're saying, you know, one of the most interesting things, I think, and as somebody, you know, again, who spent a lot of their formative years in music stores and bookstores and, you know, places like this, that for the longest time, all you would ever see, and this is something you guys touch on too, is that, you know, it was just report after report and story after story of how the culture is dying, and how it's in its death throes, and how, you know, the internet's going to put everybody out of business. And, you know, it's where it seems to be quite the opposite, in the same way that the vinyl sales resurged, that the smaller record shops, the independent record shops, also seemed to make a comeback. That, you know, places that I had shopped for years, over just even the last 5 years, I you know, will go in where it wouldn't have been busy, and just there'll be, you know, a ton of foot traffic. Obviously not within the last, you know, 6 months, unfortunately, but within the, let's look at 2019, and you know, you'll see stories about how the sales of records, that, you know, last year was the biggest record store day, you know, on record, and also, you know, highs in vinyl sales. But the, you know, the culture of it, again, it's got to speak, and I'm sure you guys found this along the way, that in the same way that people are having experiences with records and memories and you know, deep emotion tied to vinyl, is, you know, the same reason that people will seek out their local shop rather, you know, than you can get records at big box stores right now too. You know, you can walk into a Best Buy and get some Beatles reissues or something, and I'm sure Walmart has them too. But, you know, never think to buy, I'll buy my paper goods there. I'll never think to buy a record there.
Yeah, no one we talked to in this movie was like, the great thing about records is you can three clicks on Amazon and get it sent to your door, and you never have to speak to anybody. It's just as easy as buying stamps. Like, nobody said that. Everybody links the experience of buying records to the experience of going to the record store.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we talked to everybody in pre-pandemic times, but this was another thing in our movie that was sort of lying in wait to come to full bloom, and we were fortunate that it had already bloomed when we made this movie. The record store day, it is telling that record store day begins in 2008, and of course, record store day is crucial to the comeback of records, but it is crucial, and we talk about that in the movie, but it is crucial that record store day begins in Baltimore and not in a white hot music center like New York or LA or Nashville or Austin or something like that. It's an indicator that the culture of record stores is not completely dependent on the music industry and its presence in different places. It's also telling that take Mills Records in Kansas City. Mills is in a hip part of town. Mills is in the Westport neighborhood of Kansas City, which is like the nightlife neighborhood of Kansas City. But now there are a dozen other vinyl-based record stores in Kansas City itself. I mean, definitely part of the comeback of records that we try and capture in our movie is not every record store needs to be in like the most achingly fashionable part of town. You know, where you're from in Phoenix, 10 years ago, it would have been Stinkweeds, which had to be in uptown and maybe not anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's going to be 15 record stores in the Phoenix metro area. And one of them will be, you know, in a strip mall next to a State Farm Insurance. Like, and so it, like the decoupling of record stores to fashionability just makes them seem like sort of much more ubiquitous parts of our communities. Special parts of our communities, really special, but their sheer numbers indicate that they are not cute little niche businesses anymore. Like they're part of they're fundamental parts of the places we live.
It's funny, the you know, I've been shopping at Stinkweeds for years, and I actually, the last time I moved, chose the apartment I went to because of its proximity to Stinkweeds and the fact that I can walk there during cooler weather. So
I'm going to speak for Chris for a minute and say we have both done such things.
yeah.
It's like a third place. I'm sure you guys must have heard of that theory of having like a place to go that feels like, you know, like another home to you. And that for me definitely is, you know, like for a bookstore, I'll go to the Changing Hands. It's just down the street from there, or for, you know, or to pop into Stinkweeds, and to, you know, I know the people working there. I've developed relationships and will, you know, go see their band when they're playing, or you know, we'll partner on promoting something else that they're working on. And it's, you really, you know, they do become like a surrogate family almost, because you get familiar with each other over bonding through music and through records.
Yeah, and Kevin and I have talked about this a lot with the virtual cinema release of Vinyl Nation. You know, record stores along with art house cinemas and live music venues, you know, these are the places that make the neighborhoods and towns that we live in like really special places. Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised to hear someone like yourself said, I'm going to pick this apartment based on its proximity to the record stores, the bookstores, the places that I love. I mean, like, I think it's a good indicator of, you know, how a neighborhood is doing. It's like when the record store opens up, right. Essentially there. And Kevin and I would laugh when we would go to Austin for post-production. And we would stay at various locations whenever we came in the town. And one of the Airbnbs that we stayed at, it was, you know, some condo complex. And there was a hair salon down on the first floor. And naturally, it also sold records. You know, like, we would never get back in time from our post sessions to actually get to like shop there. But we would see as they were closed, we all try to like go in one time. And they're like, oh, we're closed. Like, oh, but we just want to look at the records. Like, I don't need a haircut. No one can see us on a podcast, but I don't need a haircut. But I want to look at your records. So it's and some of the best record stores that we didn't necessarily visit, but that we know of, are these like hole in the walls that, you know, like, no, you have to go check it out because there are not a ton of records there, but the records that are there are always fantastic. So like, and since they don't have very many records, they're going to turn over all the time. And so it's like, that's the genius of it. And it just keeps bringing people back again. And to your point, it's just, you know, you want to see the people there, talk to them, get to know them. And even if it's a store in a town where you've never been, mm-hmm. you kind of hope you're going to bump into somebody who's going to give you a recommendation, right? You know, that you might pull something out and they're like, oh man, you got to totally get that. Like, okay, great. I'm going to get it. I don't even know what it is, but you said it's cool. So and then take it home and you're like, man, I'm so happy that person told me to buy it. That's something you can't get on online or on Spotify. It's not the same like discovering something on in the bins. It's just something that's much more magical and joyful than just, oh, somebody suggested this playlist I should listen to. I don't know. I just don't.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, vacations I will go on or trips I have to take for work or something. One of the first things I'll do is look and see what record stores are in the area and you know, check out their selection. It's almost like a sickness, but it's a pleasant sickness, you know. There's something else that I thought was interesting that you guys included in the film for a few reasons, the manufacturing of vinyl and what goes into the packaging and so forth, presented some geek out moments for me, because there's like a shot where like archive footage or something of somebody flipping through records, and I was like, oh, that tab says split ends. I love split ends. And one of the, you know, the when they're making the gatefold sleeves, it's a Bill Callahan record that I own. I'm like, I love that record. But the thing that you guys talk about is pointing to the environmental impact too, and steps that people are taking to minimize the environmental impact, or at least lessen, by recycling vinyl to make additional records, you know, through what they cut off and so forth. Something that wasn't included in your film, but something that happened fairly recently, was one of the major vinyl plants like burned down or something. It's definitely, you know, as somebody who's anxious to, you know, a recent example, I am a big Elvis Costello fan, and there's like a 2 week delay between when the album dropped and the vinyl comes out. And it's this kind of like supply and demand, like a consequence of unprecedented resurgence in vinyl sales, being that artists are actually being impacted by not being able to get their album out on vinyl, or having to jockey for position in manufacturing. So as somebody who's fascinated by the whole process, it was great to see that included. And I'm wondering at what point you guys decided to cover that angle of it, and whether it was intentional to do so, to include the environmental impact aspect.
Yes. To your question, we always intended to focus on the manufacturing process, and we wanted to visit a handful of pressing plants because they each have a unique place within the industry. We wanted to make sure that we included something like United Record Pressings because it's the longest continuous vinyl pressing plant still operating in the U.S. We wanted to go to Quality Record Pressings in Salina, Kansas, because whenever we were talking to musicians and people in the industries, they would tell us, like, if you want the best sounding records, you got to get it pressed at QRP. So like, okay, we got to go there. But like you were saying, there was also issues in terms of the bottleneck in the manufacturing process. And because of that, that means there's new opportunities for pressing plants to reopen, because so many of those plants had closed over the years, because even though we're in a resurgence of vinyl records, we're nowhere near where we were at the apex in the late 70s, early 80s in terms of vinyl production. So we went to Gold Rush Vinyl in Austin, Texas, which Karen Kelleher started up as a business venture because she was managing bands while also working at Google, and realized I can't get records pressed when I need to. And when I eventually do, they're late and they're not good quality, and I think there's a business opportunity here. So she was able to get financing pretty quickly for that, and she actually is able to pick up a lot of that slack when those bottlenecks happen. And then finally, you have Jack White, who's all about vinyl records and is all about control over his whole musical career and process. So it's kind of natural that once he had his label and his record stores, he would create his own pressing plant, Third Man Pressing in Detroit. So we wanted to cover all those bases because they have a kind of a unique position. But to your point, even before we talked to a single one of them, Kevin and I talked about in pre-production, like, we can't go and interview any of those people at those pressing plants and not address the environmental impact. It's like, it's at the time we're doing these interviews, it's 2019. This is going to come out in 2020. That's just not responsible. So we need to understand, how are they approaching this? And so through the process, and as you see in the film, we learn about how the flash, the XX vinyl on the outside of the record after gets pressed, as well as, records that don't pass inspection, they all get reground. It's called regrind. And that eventually is pellets that go back into other vinyl records. So if it's not virgin vinyl, it's always a mix of virgin and regrind that go into records. And as you hear in our documentary, you don't want any of that going back into the landfill. So you essentially are closing that loop. But we also learned, in terms of the energy that's used and also like the water that's used, that's also recaptured. The steam gets turned back into water and is recaptured. So there's a lot more thought put into the environmental impact now than there ever was. And if you're building a plant today, you can keep those things in mind. So as Gold Rush Vinyl and Third Man Pressing come online, they have that at the forefront of their plans in terms of energy consumption and how they're running everything. And then if you're Third Man Pressing, it's going to be Jack White. It's going to be aesthetically beautiful as well.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, because one of the points that you guys make is that, or at least the manufacturers make in there, is that so little about the production itself of how you get sound to vinyl hasn't changed in over a century. And so the trick for them comes in how you manage, what goes into and what comes out of it, and then in terms of the waste and so forth. So to see how they're doing that was as somebody who cares very, very deeply about environmental impact and people's awareness of it, and reducing carbon footprint and so forth, that was, heartening to see, because you get that little bit of, we'll just call it like liberal guilt or something, where if you're crusading or trying to raise awareness of something, but then you also collect something that contributes to the ozone holes. So that was really interesting. And another, you guys made this film, at that point, zenith in the industry, and then as you're getting ready to put it out into the world, boom, pandemic, and you have everybody essentially, for a good chunk of time, things are beginning to open back up again, and you can visit in small batches, but stores were completely closed off. Did you have any of the people that you spoke to reach out to you during that time, and Is that what kind of informed how you chose to release the film and help support some of those record stores, or were those things completely independent of each other?
Chris and I made the decision ourselves to release the movie how we are releasing it now. The movie is available at vinylnationfilm.com, and we have 100 ticketing partners in 35 states plus the District of Columbia, which means that when you purchase a digital ticket through any one of them, half of those proceeds go towards our ticketing partner. And our ticketing partners are mostly independent movie theaters, record stores, a few live music venues. Mm-hmm. The institutions that are most being hurt by this pandemic. And we initially got the idea because we released the movie, and this was Chris's idea, we released the movie for one weekend on what would have been Record Store Day 2020, i.e. April 18th. Mm-hmm. Because it was at the very beginning of the pandemic, record stores were going to be forced to be closed, understandably, on their busiest day of the year. Mm-hmm. And we were really concerned that our movie, which begins on Record Store Day 2019, with hundreds of people lined up in the wee hours of the morning, we were worried that that was going to look like a postcard from a lost era.
Right.
And we were also just worried for our friends who ran record stores. And so we released the movie for one weekend on April 18th. We brought in 246 record stores as partners. Actually more like almost 300 if I remember correctly. And we let them keep 100% of the ticket proceeds for that. Because we figured our friends who ran record stores were in big trouble. And we raised nearly $37,000 for record stores in 46 states throughout America. We have continued to do it this way because we understand that our movie is part of an ecosystem, which we hope we conveyed in the movie. We feel a great responsibility to the people in our movie, the institutions they represent, and the places that our movie would play or have goodwill were we able to circulate freely right now. So because we can't, we're doing it this way. And we like to joke that we're essentially doing it backwards of how any normal movie does it, meaning we're releasing the movie online, and then we got into some film festivals this fall, so we're getting into some film festivals, and then maybe one day in the sweet by and by we'll be able to actually see it in the movie theater.
Well, I mean, everybody is scrambling for a new model right now, you know. So it's it's interesting too. I mean, and you know, again, I love going to see films in a cinema. I love actually going into the record stores and so forth. But you kind of do what you got to do. And if we don't do things like this that help support those places in the meantime, while people can't, you know, turn up in the numbers that they would normally, those places are going to be gone when we're able to. And you know, it's a really cool thing what you guys are doing. So how long now, how long is the film going to be available through vinylnationfilm.com?
So our virtual cinema release is going through November 30th. Mm-hmm. We started it back at the end of August. We timed it with the three Record Store Day drops that took were in place of original Record Store Day. So those have come and go. And then Record Store Day has a Black Friday event right after Thanksgiving. So we thought we'll just make it available through the end of November. And like Kevin said, you know, people can go to vinylnationfilm.com and click a button where to watch to find a ticket partner in their neck of the woods that they would like to support with their purchase.
Cool. To kind of like bring this in for a landing here, do you guys have a particular record store that you want to shout out here on the podcast?
Geez, there are so many. There are so many that have been so good to us.
Your favorite local, let's say. We'll make that so nobody else feels bad.
I'm based in San Francisco. You can't be based in San Francisco without shopping at Amoeba.
Of course.
The amazing thing about the record buying community in San Francisco is that you can have Amoeba, but also, you know, a dozen other record stores in city limits and at least that many in Oakland, Berkeley, and places, you know, mm-hmm. in Silicon Valley and in Marin County and stuff like that. So I kind of flip-flop, I kind of alternate between Amoeba when I'm here in town and Econa Jam Records in Oakland is my favorite when I'm in the East Bay.
Cool.
And I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So here in town, Charlie's 33s is a place that I go. But up in Santa Fe is Los Padre Records, an excellent record store. And we got them up in Taos as well and other places too. But those are the ones that would kind of come to my mind initially.
And do either one of you have a particular treasure in your collection or a story behind a particular, you know, record that really, helps you in some way connect with these people's stories who that you bring to the film? Cause you guys don't tell your own story, but there are so many beautiful stories in the film of people who, you know, who are connecting over these records.
Now, the movie isn't about us. It's about the people in it. The nation of Vinyl Nation. We are simply citizens of that nation as well. Me getting into records in 2007 overlaps almost perfectly with the same year I met my wife. And so my life with records is very much parallel to my life with her. And so the records that we've discovered together are probably the most important ones that I own to me.
Over the course of making this film, people would at times offer us a record of our choosing. And when they would ask me, well, what was I into? What did I like? I learned very quickly to say, no, I'm not going to tell you. I'm too stuck in my own lane. I want to branch out. I want to be introduced to other things. So you tell me. And when we were at Gold Rush Vinyl, Karen Kelleher made that offer to us and I gave her that stipulation. And so she put into my hand Grizz's album Ride Waves. I didn't know who Grizz was at all. Came home, put it on the turntable, and just blew me away. I just kept listening to it over and over and over again. Kevin also got a copy of it from Karen, and we both liked it. So I pushed hard to get one of those tracks into our film. So the end credits track is The Escape by Grizz. And the more than anything, the reason why I wanted to have something like that in the film is I wanted there to be something on our soundtrack that was given to us and we discovered as a result of making the film. So for me, that was kind of a nice way to do that. A little Easter egg that I also like to share for those who watch closely, or should say listen closely as well, is when you watch, there's a scene in our film that takes place at Third Man Pressing in Detroit. And if you look really closely during that scene, you'll see that we have a shot of a huge chalkboard and it's got listed all of the records that are being pressed that day.
I saw Josh Ritter's name on there.
Yeah, yeah. But if you look really closely, you'll see there's a 45 being pressed by the David Nance group called Meanwhile. And that is the song that you're listening to during that scene. And you'll see somebody actually punching holes in a 45 record. And that's the record. So just this little thing, like you're actually watching the thing you're listening to being made somewhere in the facility at that point in time. And it also is just a great track. It worked really, really well for that scene. So it's nice to find those synergies and just keep kind of discovering music even after the fact, after we had filmed.
Well, it's a beautiful film. I'm so happy that I've seen it. I've watched it twice now. And you know, there are so many amazing stories in there, and it's really, I would highly suggest it's a great film to show anybody who ever questions why you're so attached to your records. and you know, I felt like I was, you know, watching extended family as I was watching your film. So it's absolutely fantastic. And thank you guys both, Kevin and Chris, so much for taking the time here on election night to talk to me. It's been actually, you know, certainly the highlight of my day, and has soothed some of the anxiety for a little while. So I really appreciate it. And thank you guys
so much. It's our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Jared. Thanks for having us.
All right, that's it. That's the show. Again, my deep thanks to Kevin Smoker and Christopher Boone. That's vinylnationfilm.com. And click on the Where to Watch link. And it's up through November 30th. I know we pointed that out during the conversation, but just to reiterate that, so you have a few weeks left to go online and watch it and support some establishments that need it. And again, it's been a while since I've done this, so you know, I forgot to mention any of the stuff at the top. Hootenwaddle.com/limited, and I'm getting it wrong too. Hootenwaddle.com/LTD engagement. There's a player there where you can listen to all the previous episodes. Well, not all the previous episodes. There's a plug right there that I don't want to forget. I am slowly getting archived shows from the first year up on the Hootenwaddle Patreon. So if you go to patreon.com/Hootenwaddle, if you sign up at the $10 level, you can get access to archived podcasts that are not available on through regular outlets. And we've got some merch. It's all related to my other currently running podcast, What the Fork. But if you go to Redbubble and search for Hootenwaddle, there's some merch there that can help support things. Not going to lie, Hootenwaddle is in some pretty dire need of support to operate next year, thanks to the shit show 2020 has been as far as being able to get out there and move our books. So any support is appreciated, even if that is subscribing to this podcast and rating it and reviewing it and telling your friends about it. If you want to follow on social media, there is a Facebook page out there. I'm not on Facebook myself. I don't check anything on there, so don't try to get at me through that. It's been at least 2-3 months now since I was on there. And so I'm not ignoring you. If you have tried to contact me through there, I'm ignoring the entire platform. But on Instagram, I do post fairly frequently. It's LTD engagement, and on Twitter, LTD_engagement. And that's going to do it. I've got another interview in the can, so there's at least one more. I don't know, you know, I had one new episode in 6 months, so who knows what the posting schedule is going to be. But there are going to be some changes, and I'll go into greater detail with them as they get closer to fruition. But to let you know, there's going to be a transition at the end of the year. This particular podcast, I am going to stop doing. These last couple of interviews that I've recorded have reminded me how much I love talking to people. And doing these interviews. So I am going to continue to do that in some form. And that's what I'm going to give more details on as that gets closer. But it's been over 5 years that I've been doing this show, and I need to do something different. So at the end of the year, that's going to be it. And then the new thing will be in the following year, 2021. But until then, I'm going to keep trying to book as many interviews as I can and post as many of these as I can. And thank you as always for listening. And see you on down the road. This has been a Hootenwaddle production. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not check out one of our other fine podcasts available from Hootenwaddle.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any number of podcast apps. If you'd like to support Hoot and Waddle and get access to an exclusive member-only podcast, receive discounts on merch, and more, go to patreon.com/hootandwaddle.